Welcome to Office Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world.
This week, we talk with Seamus Khan about his new book, Privilege, The Making of an Adolescent Elite at St. Paul's School. On the one hand, elite social institutions, such as St. Paul's School, have opened up to women and minorities in recent decades. But on the other hand, inequality has increased and wealth is more concentrated now than since the 1920s. What explains this apparent contradiction between increasing openness, yet rising inequality? Khan draws on his own experiences as a student and then researcher at St. Paul's to help answer this question. Today, we're having Office Hours with Seamus Khan, sociologist at Columbia University and author of the brand new book, Privilege, The Making of an Adolescent Elite at St. Paul's School. Seamus, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess let's get started by talking about this book. It's about St. Paul's School. So tell us about this.
Sure. St. Paul's is a boarding, it's actually the real name of the school, and it's a boarding school up in Concord, New Hampshire. It's a boarding school I attended as a student and then went back to do some of my dissertation research, which is the basis of the book.
This school has kind of a long history, right?
Yeah, it's the school was founded in the 1850s. It's a pretty small school. It's about 500 students, but it's an incredibly wealthy school, so the endowment is around $500 million. And that makes it one of the sort of wealthier educational institutions in the world on a sort of pure per pupil basis. It's co-ed, so it went co-ed in 1969. And it's had black students and, a sort of modest population of non-white students since the 1950s. So the first black teacher was there in the 1950s. And now I'd say about 30% of the population is non-white. About 15%, maybe a little lower, of the applicants to St. Paul's end up being accepted. So it's a very competitive school environment. And the set of people who go to St. Paul's are primarily, but not exclusively, from the Northeast. So it's very much tied to sort of the old elite Northeast institutions, although increasingly it's becoming popular globally.
And just to clarify, so this is a boarding school, so is it like a high school or like more than that? Or
yeah, it's a high school, so it's okay. For students between 9th and 12th grade.
Okay.
Every student lives on campus, so all of the students live in houses on campus, and all the faculty live on campus. There are 500 students, there are about 100 faculty members, and the school is organized in a way around dorm life and also to a little bit religious education. It's an Episcopalian institution.
The book is subtitled The Making of an Adolescent Elite. So how do the adolescent elite get made at St. Paul's School?
Part of the book is about a shift in the elite. And so I talk about these two things, which I call the new elite and the new inequality. And they're tied together. And so the idea is that the character of inequality has changed in the United States in particular, but in some ways globally as well, over the last 40 years, really. So since 1968, the United States is much more unequal than it once was. But the inequality is kind of it's curious. It's driven mostly by wealth and the rising incomes of the very rich, and not so much driven by poverty. And when we usually look at inequality, we usually study poverty. So the part of the point of the book is to look at the elites and how they're trained. And the second curiosity is that when we look at inequality, we usually think of it relative to exclusion. So inequality emerges because people build moats or fences around resources. They find ways to exclude other people. And one of the curiosities sort of that I'm thinking about is that over the last 40 years, you'd be somewhat hard-pressed to argue that the world is much more exclusive. Social institutions have opened rather tremendously along racial and gendered lines in particular. And so this sort of new inequality, this democratic inequality is another term I use, or open inequality is another term I use in the book, is a way of thinking through how you can get these large increases in inequality during times wherein you also have increasing social openness.
Okay, so to sort of unpack those two arguments there, the first point about how we usually look to poverty, but instead it's really wealth that's driving it. Can you kind of explain what that means? What do you mean by people usually look to poverty to explain inequality, and how are those explanations not really holding up?
Sure. I mean, it's not that. It's just that when we think about inequality, we often think about poverty. That's sort of the thing that we think about. So that, inequality often means looking at failing institutions rather than successful ones. So examples would be the long Chicago tradition of looking at urban environments, for example. And I think that there are sort of two problems with that approach. I mean, the first would be that it's not always particularly relational. So while most of our theoretical approaches to inequality suggest that inequality is about the relationships between rich and poor, or poor in the set of social institutions, often when we look within one category, it's not particularly relational. The second problem I'd say is that, if we look at, say, income, since 1968, we see something kind of interesting. The average American hasn't really seen much of a change in their income. It probably has changed about 23-25%. And the richer people get, the richer the group that you look at, the more and more increase they've had in their income. So the richest 5-10% have seen their income go up about 2/3. The richest 1% have seen their income go up about 300%, and the richest 0.1% have seen their income go up about 500%. And so a lot of what's happened since 1968 is the ways in which the richer and richer people have seized more and more of the national wealth. And so, my idea is that, and this wouldn't simply be my idea, I should say, there's a lot of economists and other sociologists who are working on this, but the idea is that in order to understand the increases in inequality, we should look where a lot of the action is. And as it turns out, a lot of the action is among the rich, not among the poor.
So then how do we see this action at St. Paul's?
The students who go there, they end up attending Ivy League institutions at pretty astonishing rates. So the most common college kids go to is Harvard. About 1/3 of any one graduating class will end up in the Ivy League. And more than 80% will end up in the top 20 colleges and universities in the country. And so it's a place that sort of guarantees, not quite guarantees, but close enough to guarantees admission into some of the best educational institutions, college institutions. And some of the research on places like St. Paul's, what's referred to as the elite 13 boarding schools, suggests that kids who go to these institutions, though they're not necessarily better qualified than their college peers, in fact, they often appear to be less qualified. They sort of make up the bottom half of their college classes. They earn more upon leaving college than their other college peers. And that's not just because they all become investment bankers. They actually just earn more within their respective professions. And so these are institutions that are associated with the kind of, the halls of power in many ways. So John Kerry, the senator from Massachusetts, is a graduate of St. Paul's. He lived with Frank Mueller, who's the head of the FBI. And so, the vision that, senators and heads of FBI live together over their high school years at a fairly small institution, also populated by Vanderbilts and Rockefellers, not a completely inaccurate portrait of what these boarding schools look like. But they've experienced a kind of change. So in the book, the change that I describe is a change from my experience there as a student to my experience there as a faculty member. So when I was a student, my experience was marked by living in a minority student dorm. So at the time, and this was 1994, there was still a dorm on campus that was almost all minority students. And it wasn't necessarily an explicitly racist practice of the school. In fact, the school was pretty self-conscious of the fact that they had this dorm. But it was produced by the fact that the minority students and the white students generally had challenges interacting with one another. The social distance between Harlem and the Upper East Side is a lot greater than its geographic distance. And so, you know, the poorer and Black and Latino kids had challenges interacting with the sort of the children of wealth, the primarily white children of wealth. And when I returned to St. Paul's to do my research in 2005, one of the interesting things that I found was that the minority student dorm was gone. It was no longer the case that minority students all lived together. But there was a sort of new space, a new place on campus where there was a kind of social isolation. And the sets of kids who were socially isolated were the kids I would refer to as the entitled kids, the kids who believed that their legacy, their lineage was sufficient to explain their belonging at an institution like St. Paul's. And this would be part of what I think is a kind of a fundamental shift on the part of the elite. And, you know, I'd be somewhat careful about talking about this because I don't think it's the case that social inheritance no longer matters. In fact, I think it matters as much, perhaps even more, than it used to matter. But I think what's happened is that the legitimacy of the sort of cultural legitimacy of social inheritance, of explaining your position in the world relative to who your parents were and the advantages that you enjoy because of who your parents were, has declined markedly in the last 20 years. And increasingly, elites think of themselves not as a group of people with the right breeding, the right culture, the right social connections, but they think of themselves as being like everybody else. They just happen to have better skills, be more skilled. Maybe they work harder. They have greater human capital. And that explains why they are where they are. And I, you know, argue that this is a particularly pernicious shift. Insofar as social institutions really do still matter tremendously, but that the shift to explaining what are effectively social outcomes by individual capacities, the hard work, talents, things like that, has some pretty negative social impacts on our view of a social contract with one another.
So it sounds like, on the one hand, the advantages of opening up that sense of entitlement that where your, you know, who your parents are is what really matters for, you know, what your worth is. On the one hand, that seems to open up, you know, who can get into schools like St. Paul and who can have access to these kinds of opportunities. But at the same time, by making that something you can't openly talk about, it hides that it still happens, right?
Exactly. And so, in many ways, the heavily patterned character to American inequality is obscured by the individualizing of social outcomes. When we talk about the social opening up of social institutions, when I talk about the social opening up of social institutions, what I most frequently make reference to is the opening of social institutions by race and gender. So I talked about the racial categories and the ways in which Columbia has gone from being, you know, basically 0.8% Black in the 1960s to about 13%, how today it's a majority-minority institution. That's a tremendous transformation, but it says very little about the class composition of the institutions. And I think part of what's happening is that, in some ways, the absence of class as a conceptual category in the United States means that we can think about diversity within fairly homogeneous, or at least within fairly bimodal class distributions. So if you look at really, really elite institutions, what we find is that they are more racially diverse. Women are more likely to be at the institutions, but they're also richer. So even given the increases in financial aid at these elite institutions, the student body, on average, more and more of them come from the top 5, even top 2 or 1% of national earners. Mm-hmm. And so part of our explanation for this opening up is in part because of a kind of myopia on our part, our incapacity to think critically about the importance of class to explaining social position. And so in some ways, the elite have really adopted the elite have really adapted to the social transformations of the rights movements of the 1960s and accepted almost heralded in a view of openness, equality, meritocracy. I mean, you know, we can think of other sociological literature here. The omnivore thesis would in many ways support this kind of view, the idea that instead of cultural snobs, people who only like classical music, elites are increasingly cultural omnivores. They're people who consume pretty widely. And we see this with our students, or at least I see this with my students. They listen to hip-hop and jazz. They listen to some country, not modern country, but they'll listen to Hank Williams or Johnny Cash or something like that.
Something that's authentic.
Yeah, something that's authentic in some way, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so these people who've worked on this omnivorousness thesis provide, you know, a kind of support for this view that it's the elite who are really the most open in their tastes. And what's interesting about this is it allows for a cultural orientation wherein the performance of the people at the bottom is explained not by the fact that they were born there, but that they're close-minded, that they have limited sets of tastes. They don't take advantage of this open world. And so they can, in many ways, be blamed for their disadvantaged position. If only they were more open-minded, if only they found ways to take advantage and seize the flat world, then they would be able to climb out. So, the individualization of the social outcomes both helps, you know, the rich create this new, not a new, but a slightly adjusted narrative to explain their position, but also creates patterns of blame for disadvantage that help reinforce the view of a kind of deserving poor.
There was an article in the New York Times recently that featured you and your research on this and a few other people participating in a working group on elites. And in the article, one of the interesting things that you say is you sort of pose a question about, is it morally responsible for you to get your kids into very expensive schools if it will advantage them, right? And saying, well, it's hard not to do that, right? On an individual level, if you can take that opportunity, you should take it. But at the same time, sort of stepping back from that and thinking about, you know, having a few elite schools playing such a central role in maintaining inequality in the whole system. There's an interesting moral dilemma that you bring up there, and I just kind of wanted to touch on that a little bit and talk about that. So what...
Sure. I mean, you know, I don't have children, but I, you know, I'm old enough now that I have friends who have children who think a lot about public schooling. And, you know, I'm a sociologist, so I study education, so a lot of people I talk about know something about education, and they tend to be fairly progressive in their political orientations. And you know, a lot of them are highly committed to the idea of public schooling. And, you know, to think of it as both a social good and a moral good. And to remove your kid, the individual act of removing your kid from a public school, it's not clear that makes the public school a terrible place. But if the more advantaged members of a community all remove their kids from a public school, it is pretty clear that there are negative social outcomes to that move. And, you know, residential segregation is basically this pattern of the ways in which large groups of like people tend to move together. Now, I'm not a philosopher, and so I'm not particularly well-equipped to think through how to navigate a moral dilemma, but it is somewhat problematic insofar as the individual act isn't necessarily a bad thing, and it's not an explicit act of oppression. But the collected set of individual acts clearly lead to large-scale social inequalities. So, you know, if I were a parent, I don't know what I would do. You know, if you wonder about your responsibility to your children as well. Is it irresponsible not to provide your kids with the greatest opportunities that might be afforded to them? You know, the picture becomes even more muddled, which is to say, like, if you're disadvantaged, is it immoral to go to a higher status institution insofar as those institutions are often just credentialing organizations for the rich? What I was pointing to in the article, I guess what I'm pointing to here in a kind of a not so very clear way, is that sometimes these individual decisions of you know, trying to get your kid into a better school, I don't necessarily think that they're immoral acts, and they're also not acts of explicit oppression, but that the overall outcome can be quite harmful. What I also spoke to, which wasn't really reported there, was that individual level decisions, while powerful, are unlikely to make large scale transformations of social institutions. And so, in many ways, we need a much more organized social policy. I mean, if every rich person made a decision to send their kids to public school, I guess we would have a fairly profound social transformation, but that's fairly unlikely. Mm. If every academic decided to send their kids to public school, probably not much would happen overall to the public school institutions. And so, you know, what I was hoping to do is point to the importance of social policy factors, not just individual decisions about these kinds of schools. I mean, the criticism could also be leveled in a much more personal way at me, not simply as to, you know, whether or not you send your kids to school, but whether or not you choose to participate in these institutions as an academic. So I teach at a very wealthy, very advantaged social institution that helps continue the advantages of the already advantaged. And so to teach at such an institution is often to engage in a set of activities that could easily be read as helping perpetuate, not alleviate, inequality. And so as a scholar of inequality, that's something I think about from time to time.
Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I mean, I guess sort of I'll make the counter argument for you, since you're being kind of critical of yourself here, is that if you have a more educated elite who understand their position and sort of in proportion to others in a more sort of accurate, sober manner, then that could maybe lead to some change from the inside as well, correct?
Absolutely. But I'll continue with my cynicism. it's, you know, educational institutions today, it's not really clear what they do in terms of the development of skills or capacities in students. Richard Aram's going to have a book that's going to come out in a couple weeks that will have a fairly dramatic claim about the set of educational institutions and colleges in this country. And basically, Aram finds that people don't learn much at college, especially in the first 2 years. More importantly, I mean, in addition to Aram's point, others have found that if you look at work hours of college students, they've drastically declined since the 1960s, so that out-of-classroom work time has gone down from about 24 hours to around 14 hours. And it's not explained by the proliferation of colleges, so it's not explained by the fact that there are just more colleges out there and they're not of all, you know, the same elite quality. It's not explained by shifts in choice of major. It's not explained by technology. It's not explained by the fact that people have to work more outside of school. I mean, educational institutions seem to be credentialing organizations that justify higher wages. And given the class composition of these institutions, you know, to sort of quote or paraphrase from Bourdieu, what educational institutions seem to increasingly do is convert birthright into credentials. So rather than the crass aristocratic outcomes where it's simply the last name that creates an inheritance, we now have found institutions that create this kind of credentialing. But the process is largely similar. Now, it is a little more open than it used to be, but not much. I mean, if we look at the overall levels of mobility in the United States, they're pretty low. And if we look at the class composition of our institutions, they leave us a lot to be embarrassed by.
Do you think that this is something that, I mean, I think in general, it's safe to say that Americans underestimate the amount of inequality in society, mm-hmm. and sort of underestimate just how concentrated wealth is in the hands of a few. Do you think that that has a big effect on like public policy behind supporting public schools or recognizing that these are problems? Or do you think that these new developments just sort of, as you said earlier, just kind of mask the problem so people don't even see it anymore?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, so there is a lot of evidence that people don't really know much about the wealth distribution of the United States, and that they don't value the particular wealth distribution. So, you know, this is experimental work that shows people different wealth distributions and which societies they think are better. And in general, people think that societies with less inequality are better. And then asking Americans the kind of society that they live in, both in terms of the overall distribution of wealth and the potential for mobility, they basically identify that we live in Sweden. And then when you tell them that we don't live in Sweden, that we live in a massively unequal and often pretty immobile society, they're quite shocked. Now, why do they believe this? It's not clear. I mean, you know, if I were a different academic, I would tell you some kind of Gramscian story of hegemony and of false consciousness and the ways in which people are tricked into believing things that simply aren't true. But I think that there are also, you know, some greater social explanations for this, which have a lot to do with the fact that the forms and patterns of segregation in this country, and I don't mean racial segregation, I just mean residential segregation, mean that in general people's reference categories often look a lot like themselves, and that the ranges of wealth that they see are fairly constrained, unless you're actually really rich, in which case you have a sense of just how much richer the really rich are from you. But it means that unlike in other social contexts where you have some degree of class integration in residential living, that we often don't see the ways in which the others live, either the poor or the rich. And it helps obscure a lot of the inequalities that would otherwise become very present to us if we just looked outside our door.
Here's a very large question, but I'll try to narrow it down and make it a little more manageable. This working group has more of an international take as well that you're trying to establish, mm-hmm. right? So it's not just looking at America. And intergenerational mobility is greater now in a lot of European countries, for example. What's different there? Like, looking just at the schooling aspect, maybe. Do these kind of schools like St. Paul's not exist in Sweden, or are other universities, other countries like that? Or what's different?
The intergenerational mobility questions are actually really tricky because of a whole host of data problems. And you speak to somebody else about these maybe than me, although I kind of have a pretty good sense of them. Early in the 1980s, Gary Becker, when he became the president of the American Economic Association, wrote this famous paper that basically said, kids don't really inherit much from their parents. That high earnings as well as low earnings, are largely earned, not inherited. And, you know, the problem for Becker was basically that his data were really poor. And with the PSID, the Panel Study of Income Dynamics, we've had some better ways of looking longitudinally, of estimating the overall levels of mobility. And, Becker claimed that the intergenerational elasticity, which is basically a measure that looks at how much differences, say, in your earnings and my earnings could be explained by differences in our parents' earnings. So a value of zero would mean that, you know, none of the difference in your earnings and my earnings could be explained by differences in our parents' earnings. A value of one would mean that all of it. And Becker, you know, found that it was around 0.2, which is pretty low, which is basically where Scandinavia and Canada are right now. That value, as data have gotten better and better, has increased and increased. So if you look at Gary Solon's work, The Economist, he says it's around 0.4. And one of the problems with Solon's work is that he often looks at just particular points and periods of people's lives. So comparing parents at the age of 45 to kids at the age of, like, say, 27.
Yeah.
And new estimates that look at moving averages, so by this guy Bhaskar Mazumdar, who's at the Federal Reserve Bank in Chicago, show that the value might be closer to 0.6. Now, 0.6 is a huge value. It means that you're looking at 5 to 6 generations before the rich and the middle class make the same amount. Now, why do we have this in the United States and folks in other nations don't? Well, particularly in developed nations, there's a considerable amount of evidence that the degree of inequality is highly tied to the amount or the potential of mobility, so that higher levels of inequality generally mean lower levels of mobility. And so the first answer to this question would be, well, we have more inequality, and that's part of the reason why. The second would be the structure of the welfare state, that in general, people think, people used to say, like, oh, the problem with inequality and poverty is a wealth problem. And so the idea would be to grow your way out of those challenges. That, to me, seems to be decreasingly true, then, and a sort of recognition that the problems of inequality aren't problems of how much money or do we have enough money, but they're problems of distribution. And in a lot of other states, the distributive mechanisms, the forms of redistribution of social wealth, or even just distribution of social wealth, are a lot stronger. So there you can think of examples of the welfare state, but also of schooling, and those institutions are quite more varied. The French have the equivalent of St. Paul's, and the Grande École, the sets of things that Pierre Bourdieu looked at. And those things, they're supposedly more equitable than St. Paul's insofar as they're free institutions that anyone can have access to through test taking. But they're, as Bourdieu famously found in the state nobility, they're heavily patterned upon class basis. So educational institutions don't always create the kinds of mobility that we would expect. One last little piece of research on this, which provides a kind of interesting puzzle. I think that educational institutions do a lot to arrest social inequality. That is, during periods in time when people are in educational institutions, a lot of the inequality that emerges through other parts of social life is stopped. And we can see this through a lot of the data that looks at when inequality grows. So what are the periods in time within which you have increasing levels of inequality? And the findings out of, a bunch of school studies, the Baltimore School Study in particular, find that a lot of the increases in inequality happen during the summer, not during the school year. And that during the school year, increases in inequality basically stop. And this points to the ways in which, what schools often do is, particularly not before college, is that they help stop inequality. They help put a halt to it in some way. And that time out of school helps produce a lot of inequality. So we see a lot of inequalities by the time kids enter kindergarten. And then we see a lot of those inequalities continue to expand through basically the fifth grade over summers. And part of what that shows is the ways in which the social outcome of inequality, of economic inequality, has in its foundations not really differences in schooling, but differences in experiences and time outside of schooling. That was a really long answer.
Well, that was a long question, wasn't it? I was kind of asking for it. Why are countries different? Can you tell me in 2 minutes or less? Is there anything we haven't talked about yet that you want to touch on?
I don't think so. I mean, I'd say one other thing, which is that, we kind of think of today as being really exceptional, that the increases in inequality by the raising of wealth of the rich is something that's really, truly, it's outlandish and really unique. But I would say that the reason it looks exceptional is because in the immediate post-war period, there was comparatively low levels of inequality and high levels of mobility, so between 1945 and 1968. And though we tend to read, sort of the classic American condition by that moment, it seems to me that that moment is actually the exceptional one, and that most of American history has been marked by really high levels of inequality. This is actually what the next book that I'm writing is about the ways in which actually America, it has long been a fundamentally unequal nation, and that the equality that we associate today with America may be a kind of a historical blip or a tremendous outlier in what is otherwise a nation that's often marked by the kind of open inequality that we see today.
Well, this has been a great discussion.
Great. Thanks for thinking of me for this.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And office hours are over for the week. To subscribe to this podcast or to learn more about the research discussed today, check out our website at societypages.org/officehours. As always, thanks to my Office Hours co-hosts, Jesse Wozniak, Sarah Loggison, and Arturo Biocchi. And thanks to the U of M's College of Liberal Arts for their technical and financial support. See you soon.